The tectonic shift, I would call it, towards sustainable investing is accelerating. Meanwhile, there aren't nearly enough asset managers and financial advisors with the comprehensive sustainability expertise and skill set to actually do the work. And so this presents a great opportunity for those in the field, in the financial services industry, to upskill and position themselves to serve that growing sustainability demand, because a lot of people are asking for them.
Welcome to the Future Ready Advisor Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Sivarajan, wealth management consultant and behavioral scientist. Join me and my guests, from industry experts to top advisors, as we explore the pain points that financial advisors face, how they can solve them, free up their time, and make their practice future ready. Hi, everyone. I'm Sam Sivarajan. Welcome to today's episode of the Future Ready Advisor. Today, I'm here with Joanna Klimchak, who oversees CREO in Canada. Joanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here, all the way from Montreal. Let me quickly introduce you to our audience. Joanna Klimchak oversees the Canadian market at CREO, a charity and global network of wealth owners, family offices, and family foundations investing to solve the climate crisis. Headquartered in New York City, they partner with their members in 30-plus countries to catalyze billions of dollars of private capital into climate solutions and the decarbonization transition, with a goal of $100 billion by 2025. CREO also unlocks climate finance through effectuating collaboration between its membership, community, and other actors in the decarbonization landscape, such as institutional investors, governments, and NGOs. Previously, Joanna was a management consultant at the Boston Consulting Group, where she helped leading North American corporations develop and implement strategies to decarbonize. Prior to this, Joanna co-founded My Vision, an international accelerator for student entrepreneurs, building companies that tackled global problems in line with the UN Development Goals. Joanna is a Rhodes Scholar and has a master's degree in public policy from the University of Oxford and a bachelor's degree in commerce from McGill. Joanna, welcome to the episode.
Thank you, Sam.
Joanna, can you share with us a little bit about CREO, its mission, some examples, and your journey in this space?
Most certainly. So CREO was launched in 2011 by a small group of American family offices actively investing in clean tech, with the view that by working together, they could more effectively advance climate-related goals. Fast forward to today, CREO is an NYC-headquartered charity, as you noted, with a mission to catalyze $100 billion into the decarbonization transition by 2025. And this is all in support of the Paris Agreement, which I'm happy to elaborate on later. CREO partners with its over 200 families around the world and other asset owners, specifically in 30 countries. And right now, we boast a climate and sustainability investment portfolio of over 1,500 companies and 300 funds, likely the largest climate portfolio that we know of, at least in the world. And so how CREO does its work within this frame of focus is across six broad pillars, and I'll just name them very quickly. One is we originate, review, and match over 1,000 deals annually of climate companies and funds with our membership to facilitate investment. Two, we connect and coordinate membership and other high impact efforts across the community. Three, we conduct actionable research and analysis, including benchmarking data among other research, to build investor confidence to deploy more capital with speed and scale in this space. Fourthly, we deliver peer-to-peer and expert-led programming for the same reason. Fifthly, we offer a mission-aligned advisory practice to members who want to go into a deep dive, perhaps on an area that they're interested in that needs a little bit more effort and analysis and partnership. And finally, we partner with a variety of actors that you noted across the sustainability landscape to unlock broader forms of capital towards the climate, everything to do with combating the climate crisis. So this includes institutional finance, this includes government, NGOs, among others. So that's CREO in a nutshell.
That's fascinating, Joanna. How did you get involved in the climate change space?
Oh, well, for me, sustainability has been at the core of my full career over the last 15 years, both on the social dimensions and environmental. When it comes to climate more specifically, the private sector will need to finance 80% of the required investment that will get us to reach net zero by 2050. So for my joining CREO was really because I see immense capacity in CREO towards catalyzing transformative global flows of capital towards combating the climate crisis. In terms of more broadly across my career, I am someone who matches values with my work from the get-go, and this is a global emergency that needs all hands on deck.
Awesome.
So here I am.
CREO recently published a very interesting report called Catapulting Canada's Clean Economy. It has a very provocative title and thesis, and I enjoyed reading it. Can you walk our audience briefly through that report and some of the inflection points you referenced in it that family offices and ultra high net worth investors are leveraging in this space?
With pleasure. So let me start with the thesis. Canada has a major economic opportunity and vital responsibility to build a global competitive clean economy for itself. It needs not just to keep pace with its peers like the US and the EU, but really to lead strategically in key areas of its capability to prosper economically and environmentally in our changing world. And so getting this done requires coordination across the private sector, the public sector, and the social sector, within which family offices have a unique and leading role to play to advance goals. In short, the family office toolkit consists of a wide variety of leverage points that we see from our work with CREO, but we summarize in this report four broad areas, including investment attributes, philanthropic capacity, networks of influence, and their industry knowledge base from operating businesses and their investment experience that can be levered in very creative and catalytic ways to advance Canada's clean economy. So that's the thesis, really, Sam. It's identifying the fact that we are in a changing world and Canada's economy depends on us being competitive and servicing that changing world. Then in terms of what we actually provide from there in the report, I would summarize in three broad areas. The first is a framework that family offices can use, or family enterprises, family foundations, let's call it families broadly speaking. They can use this to define their goals with regards to advancing Canada's clean economy. And we articulate this through a very simple mechanism. It's prioritizing actions that both match decarbonization targets for the world and for Canada, and then matching that with industry capabilities and advantages that Canada has. By doing so, we can really prioritize and advance where we already have skill, ability, and know-how to service what the world needs going forward. We call that strategic action in the framework. The other dimension of two there is catalytic action. When I say catalytic, we mean very much thinking about how every one investment dollar a family puts to work can actually catalyze many more in the ecosystem or attract more investment into the ecosystem. So an example is putting money in a certain company and perhaps sharing it with their community can act as a catalyzer to facilitating more investment. Or informing a public policy can act as a lever to creating systems level change that goes much further than the $1 that was invested. So that's on the framework. And secondly, in terms of the next piece that the report provides, which is something you alluded to, it's an invitation for families to assess the unique leverage points that they hold in their particular family office, which can be used to lever against those specific targets. So I'm happy to speak to a little bit to those four broad categories, Sam, if that's helpful, to give you some examples of what those are.
Yeah, I think it would be. I was going to say, you did reference a couple of examples, tangible examples in the report that showcased a little bit of how those different four inflection points can be used or catalyzed, as you say. It would be great if you could walk through one or two of those just to give that tangibility to the listeners.
Yeah, with pleasure. So interestingly, any one family tends to straddle using a few of the leverage points. So let me perhaps start by identifying some sub-examples of what those are and then how families use them. So the four categories, we talked about investment attributes. First of all, there are trillions of dollars being transferred between generations, like family generations, over the next 30 years. That's a lot of capital that can be used to the $4 trillion needed annually to get the planet to net zero by 2050. Families also have a long-term view typically on investment stewardship, something that the transition desperately requires. Another example is risk tolerance and nimbleness. A lot of the families that CREO works with have a capacity to take on risks in ways that other asset owners in the market do not. And that is a mechanism that can be levered towards filling market gaps that otherwise don't get touched. On philanthropic capacity, just talked about investment, you see that families have a capacity to perhaps partner investment capital with philanthropy when it's needed. And so, Sam, we see examples in the market of what we call blended vehicles, where we are de-risking higher risk market investments. Perhaps it's in a higher risk geography or on a to-be-proven solution. And the philanthropy acts as the first loss tranche. And when so doing, families have been able to attract institutional finance to deals that otherwise wouldn't happen using their philanthropy. Many other examples of philanthropy exist, but I'll keep it brief. On networks of influence, the third leverage point we talk about, families have very unique and useful industry alliances that they belong to, or other communities and relationships that they have held over years, sometimes generations in the family, that make them very powerful conveners, which is what we need in order to advance some of these bigger solutions. And lastly, their knowledge base can be used in a variety of ways, whether it's they have an expertise in a given industry, and I'll highlight an example where they bring that insight to the table, which unlocks more investment in this ecosystem. So one family that we work with, I'll anonymously share that they're in the real estate industry using all of those tools in incredible ways. So they come to CREO, lever CREO's deal pipeline to identify new and up and coming real estate decarbonization solutions. They then go and partner up with that company and invite them to test their product on their existing real estate assets. They then, if that solution works, have signaled the communities that this family office belongs to, including CREO, that, hey, so-and-so is this company has a viable solution. Let's all back it and invest it, acting as a market signal. And then at the end, they also lever their operating assets in real estate to then buy up that solution and actually implement it in their operating businesses as a pathway to decarbonize their real estate. So that's levering all those tools in the toolkit, not to mention CREO has introduced this family office to policymakers, industry peer groups, and federal research councils, where they have been very valuable expertise and insight providers in roundtables that have been advanced systems level solutions. So there you have an example of a real flywheel effect in one industry through these leverage points.
That's great. It sounds like there's a broad spectrum, and dare I say it, an overused word, a holistic solution to a major problem that we are all dealing with as a society. What message do you have for those watching the bad news on climate? Do you think that we're starting to make progress? I mean, it certainly seems like there are pieces that you're putting to place at CREO, but without encouraging complacency, do you see, can you see bright spots in the catapulting activities that you've been mentioning?
Absolutely. Let me maybe start with what you said about bad news on climate. It should really remind us about the urgency of the problem, which is crucial to gaining needed coordination. From there, I would encourage any individual, including family offices, to take that reminder and translate it into a vision of a green future. So what does that end state actually look like? Sometimes it's easy to get bogged down in the problem, but what if we can envision the world that we want to create? And what does that actually look like? Who's doing what and what changes will be present in your individual life? This really clarifies the direction of change and motivates action, be it at the personal level, family level, community, nation, globally. So we all have a part to play. And that's why I would say on the response to the bad news, in terms of are we making progress? Yes, absolutely. Though it's important to note that progress isn't even. And I'll highlight a couple examples to materialize some of this. I'll highlight some at the global level and some at the Canada national level. At the global level, it's important to note that emissions of CO2 have not yet meaningfully dropped. And we are continuously at risk of catastrophic climate change if we do not curb these fast enough. That said, lots of progress to piggyback on. A few examples. Before the Paris Agreement, which took place in 2015, and for those who may not know, the Paris Agreement, it was an agreement made by countries around the world aiming to limit the warming of the planet to 1.5 degrees by the end of the century, which includes reducing CO2 emissions by 45% by 2030 compared to 2010 levels and to reach net zero by 2050. So with that background, before that Paris Agreement was made, the world was on track to warming by 3.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Since then, stated policies put the world on track for a 2.5 degree world. And that number was updated in the last couple of years by announced pledges, which could limit the planet to 1.7 degrees, so we're a 0.2 off from the target, but much more advanced from where we were. Obviously, those are targets. Implementation is going to matter. So a couple of data points on implementation that should give us a sense of hope. The global volume of climate-focused equity transactions in private markets right now is growing on average by 50% year by year. From 2021 to 2022, it actually doubled. So we're really seeing acceleration in volume of deals and actual investments made towards them. Another example is the net zero tracker in the UK assessed that 92% of all of global GDP currently is covered by net zero commitments. And then to give an even more specific example, coal. Coal is one of our world's largest polluters, and consumption has decreased significantly in North America and Europe over the last number of years, decades even. Alberta, our province in Canada, will by the end of this year completely have removed its reliance on coal, which is 7 years before the target. So lots to celebrate. This isn't also to say that, unfortunately, there is a rise in coal consumption, particularly in Asia. So that rebalances the equilibrium. But it is to say that it's possible and we can do it. And there's a lot to ride on in terms of these tailwinds and energy for decarbonizing the planet. In terms of Canada, if you want me to give one or two more, Budget 2023, which was announced earlier this year, of course, was Canada's industrial policy response to the US Inflation Reduction Act, which is the first and largest ever policy commitment and incentives plan for climate that we have ever seen. Canada's offers $80 billion in tax incentives to curb our emissions. We also rank second in the world after China for our ability to service end-to-end electric vehicle battery supply chains. So we should be really investing in this. A lot of carrots and sticks in play, and lots to really galvanize behind, as there is possibility that we could get to 1.5 and cap our emissions to that.
That's a great overview, Joanna. If I can be slightly controversial, you mentioned a great point about coal reduction in Canada. You also mentioned on the offset that coal consumption is increasing in countries like Asia. There are, of course, lots of people that would say, well, why do we need to make this climate change efforts? Because Canada is on an absolute level, a very low polluter. And when other countries at an absolute level are adding to the problem far faster than we can reduce it, why should we do anything? Is there any comment that you would make on that? Or is that am I delving into the realm of political debate?
No, certainly. I think it's important to talk about these things. The first thing is to note that the planet is warming and everyone has a role and has had a contribution to that planet warming, including especially developed countries. The second thing to note is developed countries have more capacity than lesser developed countries in order to curb those emissions. And then the third thing to know is every individual has a role to play wherever that geography is, because the 1.5 degree target isn't, you're right, going to rely on Canada's decarbonization alone, but it does rely on the solutions that we're going to build to apply wherever in the world. So when I mentioned, for example, electric vehicles and EV batteries, and that Canada has a competitive advantage in building these, we need to think about that as a global solution, not just a Canada solution. And so building that here at home, yes, helps us decarbonize, but it also will help the US decarbonize, one of the world's largest emitters. It will also help other countries decarbonize because they will then buy those solutions from us. So actually, because we have the capacity to build those solutions and here in Canada, we have a responsibility to leaning in to get other countries towards that net zero goal.
And by the way, to your point, those are economic opportunities for Canada in terms of jobs, in terms of GDP production, in terms of growing our economy. And if I can be very, very simplistic about it, climate isn't something that is a local phenomenon. So the fact that China is polluting or India is polluting, it doesn't mean that it's not going to affect the weather patterns that we see in Canada, as we've seen over the last few years with wildfires or water or droughts or anything else that we have.
And I'll add to say, the actions that individuals take can be at the local level or they could be internationally. There's nothing stopping a Canadian also from investing in solutions or projects in another part of the world that is higher emitting, be it China and the United States as an example. And so thinking about that is also useful. That said, I know I wrote a report on building Canada's clean economy, but that was specific to the opportunity that we have to seize to what you just highlighted.
So let's dive into that a little bit. As you say, you point out in the report that much of our economy, the Canadian economy, depends on fossil fuels. So how do we prepare our economy and people's livelihood, jobs that are in sectors that are fossil fuel dependent? How do we prepare them for a lower carbon footprint future by balancing the need for jobs with the risks that we are talking about from climate change?
Really, the short version of the answer is about seizing the immense opportunity for job creation through building our clean economy. So I think, Sam, it's less about the balance and more about seizing the opportunity. But of course, it's also acknowledging this is a transition and we need to move with speed, but we need to respect that the fact that there are steps to getting there one by one. So if I elaborate a little bit more, as you highlighted, today's fossil fuels account for 6 to 9% of Canada's GDP, 20 to 25% of our exports, and a strong tax base. We also, at the same time, know that the future is a clean one or a cleaner one, which demands alternatives to oil and gas. This is why there's an imperative that Canada positions itself over time as a world-class energy producer in the clean economy in the forthcoming world. And this is a movement that happens piece by piece. I've pulled some data on this for our call that I thought was useful to bring in. This is by the Clean Economy Canada, a think tank here at home, that Canadian jobs in clean energy are set to grow by 7% a year from about 500,000 in 2025 to 2.7 million in a net zero 2050. And this at the same time, so whilst this is happening, we're meant to potentially lose up to 1.5 million jobs in fossil fuel industries. When you put that kind of together, the 2.7 million dramatically offsets the 1.5 million. So we're not only in a healthy way replacing those jobs, but creating much more. And like I said, that's over a period of 27 years now, right? So it's keeping that optimism, creating jobs, and looking towards a transition step by step. One other thing I wish to add is I personally think it's important to honor the individuals who have been behind creating Canada's energy economy that has contributed significantly to the quality of life in Canada and a lot of the wealth that has supported this country. And at the same time, you know, celebrate the opportunity that those very individuals with their deep expertise and skill set have to slightly transition those for that clean economy in the future. I think it's important to highlight that, that we really honor where we come from and where we're going to go.
I think that makes total sense. I think we have to have a vision for the future, but take steps in a thoughtful and a coordinated way. But power plants aren't built overnight. And I think a transition from the economy of the past to the economy of the future isn't going to happen overnight, but we need to think about it. So we talked a little bit about family offices, the ones that Creo works with. I'm wondering if I can ask, particularly for our listeners, to expand that thinking to what role investors in general can play here. I know that you talked about the report that the family offices, for example, are seeding high-risk investments that later will be attracting more traditional forms of capital, whether it's institutional investors, high net worth, or retail investors. Can you talk a little bit about that in general and maybe more specifically where you see opportunities or a role for non-Creo family office members shaping this economy of the future?
Absolutely, Sam. I'll speak about investors in general and then a little bit more family offices within that group. My advice to investors in general is to lean in. 80% of as climate investment, as I mentioned, is going to come from the private sector. There are tons of deals out there across every asset class, every climate sector. And so lots of opportunity. And frankly, the advantage to doing this work is now. So we can get involved. For investors who are interested, particularly in Canada's clean economy, I wish to be strategic and catalytic within that. I've got three areas that I thought I'd highlight because they are market gaps that I would consider looking to for filling. One is for ventures that are commercializing. In other words, those that are moving from proven technologies to market. We really need to see more capital support there to keep our companies here at home and to have them thrive in Canada as they grow. This isn't unique to the climate sector, but it certainly is apparent there. The second is for a growth equity company seeking scale and adoption, in addition to organizational operational maturation of companies. Those spaces with larger check sizes also need a lean in and sometimes are perhaps some Canadians may say too easily warmed by our friends to the south. And so invitation to all of us here in Canada. And third is for demonstration plants. So think first of a kind projects, a plant that is decarbonizing cement or steel. These are really big projects and facilities in industries that, frankly, Canada is deeply involved in, think heavy industry, whereby capital is a little more risk averse on average to entering. And so we need to find ways to pool our capital, perhaps use blended approaches to support those. So that's investors in general. Family offices within that, I would say same thing, plus to lever their unique family office edge or capacity within this ecosystem to accelerate the transition. So this goes back to the leverage points that I talked about earlier. What networks does a family have? What knowledge base? What philanthropic capacity along with investment interests do they have? And how can they partner those in a way that, frankly, few others can, but through that create some unique add value in the market? And the last thing I'd say for families, both those who are getting started and those who have been dabbling or perhaps even long doing climate investing, is to not go at it alone. There's really so much to learn from peers and partners in this space, and it's really moving with speed and scale. There's new investment structures, not to mention climate science, that comes out every single day. So leaning into peers and communities will help you go a lot further, a lot faster. And Creo sees this regularly even with the families that it works with. And so I would encourage that.
Awesome. This has been a very, very interesting and intriguing conversation, Joanna. We are coming to the end of our podcast, so I have a few final rapid-fire questions that I ask of all my guests. So if you're ready to go, question number one is, professionally, what is the most important lesson you have learned over the years?
Align your career with making the world a better place. Simple as that.
That's a great lesson, if you can apply it. So, and avoid temptations along the way, I suspect.
I would say the temptation is often in that world. There's so much to do and so much money to be made too. I think that people need to keep those two things in mind.
That's great. That's a great lesson. Number two, what is one practical tip you would offer listeners keen on applying your insights?
I'd say do not get bogged down in perfecting climate investment strategies before getting started. Some preparation is important, but most of the learning comes from actually participating in the market.
Great. And last but not least, any parting words of advice for our listeners?
Yes, I understand you have a number of financial advisors and planners that listen to your podcast, Sam. So my advice will be tailored to them. The tectonic shift, I would call it, towards sustainable investing is accelerating. Meanwhile, there aren't nearly enough asset managers and financial advisors with the comprehensive sustainability expertise and skill set to actually do the work. And so this presents a great opportunity for those in the field, in the financial services industry, to upskill and position themselves to serve that growing sustainability demand, because a lot of people are asking for them.
Great. Good advice. It is the industry of the future, and it's going to be more of a topic of conversation between investors and their advisors. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this episode. Joanna, this has been lots of fun with lots of really thought-provoking conversation and tips to take away. If listeners want to learn more about you or find out about Creo and its mission, where do they go?
They can go to our website, www.creosyndicate.org, or happily message me on LinkedIn.
That's great. Joanna, thank you so much for joining us today on the Future Ready Advisor.
Thank you, Sam. This was fun.
In today's episode of the Future Ready Advisor, my guest was Joanna Klimchuk. Joanna oversees CREO in Canada. CREO is a global network focusing on mobilizing private capital into climate solutions. Here are my three takeaways from our conversation. Number one, investment opportunity in sustainable solutions. Joanna emphasizes the accelerating shift towards sustainable investing. There's a vast opportunity for financial advisors and asset managers to cater to the growing demand for comprehensive sustainability solutions. I agree that this theme is here to stay, and that advisors need to be able to engage with clients in a productive and meaningful way. Number two, Canada's role in climate solutions. Joanna talked about the role of family offices in propelling Canada's clean economy. She identifies how family offices can leverage their unique attributes to advance goals in clean energy and the impact they can make in key sectors. I believe that this is just the beginning. And like most other trends that started with institutional and family office investors and then migrated to high net worth and retail investors, this push towards clean energy and climate solutions will migrate to other investors as well. Number three, job creation in the clean economy. Joanna highlighted the job creation opportunities in the transition to a low-carbon future. Despite the potential loss of jobs in fossil fuel industries, there is a substantial opportunity to create new roles in the clean energy sector. I think, like all previous transitions, we may all agree on the desired end state, but debate the journey to get there. I believe a pragmatic approach that balances long-term and short-term goals and different stakeholders' perspectives is critical, as well as the ability to compromise by all parties. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Future Ready Advisor. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast, and if you could rate it while you're at it, I would appreciate it. Visit samsivarajan.com, where you can download a behavioral coaching guide and find other resources. Join me in the next episode for more tips and tools to make your practice future ready.